This is track 2 of lecture 5 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Observe, the crucial point is that in a free market, the more important employments for oil would have outbid the less important ones, and the reduction in the supply of oil would have been taken out exclusively at the expense of the marginal employments of oil. That is, at the expense of the least important employments for which the previously larger supply of oil had sufficed. But of course, we did not have a free market. We had price controls. Price controls prevented the more important employments of crude oil from outbidding the less important employments. They prevented the most vital and urgent needs for oil from outbidding the most marginal. For example, during the oil shortage, one could read stories in the newspapers about truck drivers not being willing to deliver food supplies to southern Florida for fear of being unable to obtain fuel for the return trip up the length of the Florida Peninsula. I even recall a story about the operation of oil rigs off the coast of Louisiana being threatened as the result of an inability to obtain supplies of certain oil products needed for their continued functioning. Now, it is simply insane that such vital activities should suffer for a lack of oil, that even the production of oil itself should be threatened. On a free market, it could never happen. Such vital uses for oil would always be able to outbid any less urgent employment for all the oil they required. But under price controls, even these most vital employments are prohibited from outbidding any other employment that can pay the controlled price. Price controls simply paralyze rational action. In effect, they bring together at an auction for oil a trucker needing fuel to deliver food supplies, and a housewife needing gasoline to take an extra shopping trip to the supermarket, and they prohibit the trucker from outbidding the housewife. They bring together oil men needing lubricants for their wells and homeowners seeking oil to heat their garages, and they prohibit the oil men from outbidding the homeowners. In a word, price controls make it illegal to act rationally. Our discussion of how a free market channels factors of production in limited supply to their most important employments, and how it responds to changes in economic conditions, leads to a further characteristic of a free market, which we have already seen and are now in a position to appreciate even more. And that is that in a free market, the production and consumption of each good is harmoniously integrated with the production and consumption of all other goods. Back in Lecture 3, we saw how the uniformity of profit principle keeps the production of the various goods in proper balance. We also saw how the concern of businessmen to produce at the lowest possible costs made possible the maximum availability of labor for the production of other things, because cost savings mean largely labor savings. Now we can understand even more fully how in a free market, the production of each good is carried on in a way that is maximally conducive to the production in the rest of the economic system. Because we are now in a position to understand how the concern with costs of production promotes the production of other goods every time it leads to the substitution of a lower priced factor of production for a higher priced one in limited supply, such as the use of unskilled labor where skilled labor was previously required, or the use of a less expensive quantity of aluminum where a more expensive quantity of copper was previously required, and so on. All we have to do is realize that the less expensive factor is less expensive because its marginal importance to the consumers is less. To substitute a less expensive factor for a more expensive one, therefore, is to make it possible for the consumers to obtain something to which they attach greater marginal importance at the expense of something to which they attach smaller marginal importance. The fact that in a free market, production is always carried on at the lowest possible cost that businessmen can achieve means that the production of each thing is carried on not only with the least possible amount of labor, but with those specific types of labor and other factors of production in limited supply whose use represents the least possible impairment of the satisfaction of alternative wants. Production is always carried on with those specific types of labor and other factors of production in limited supply whose use represents the least possible impairment of the satisfaction of alternative wants. We can observe the operation of this principle in every cost calculation that businessmen make. To take some examples, let us assume that a railway company is contemplating the extension of its line across a body of water, or that an electric company is contemplating the construction of additional generating capacity. In these cases, and in practically every other case, alternative methods of production are possible. The railway could build a bridge across the water, it could tunnel under the water, build a ferry, or perhaps detour around the body of water. In each instance, a variety of further alternatives are possible, such as where to construct the bridge, what materials and design to use, and so on. In the same way, the electric company could build a coal-powered plant, a water-powered plant, an oil or gas-powered plant, or an atomic-powered plant. And again, major variations are possible in each of these alternatives. Now, each method of production and each variant of any given method requires some different combination of factors of production in limited supply. Each of these factors of production has its own alternative uses in various other employments. For example, the bridge requires workers with the special skills required to build bridges. These workers could be employed in building bridges elsewhere or in building skyscrapers, and of course in a variety of lesser jobs. The tunnel requires the special skills of sandhogs. These men may first have to be trained, and a long period of time will go by during which they are unavailable to produce a different variety of goods than the bridge builders. Again, different methods require different combinations of materials that may themselves be in limited supply or require different combinations of labor skills or limited materials in their own production. The point here is that the selection of any given method of production has its own unique impact on the rest of the economic system in terms of withdrawing factors of production from possible alternative employments. The fact that businessmen select the lowest cost methods of production means that they try to produce each good with the least overall impairment of the production of alternative goods. Because to produce at the lowest cost means to use that combination of limited factors of production that has the lowest total marginal significance in alternative employments. Now, not only is the production of each good harmoniously integrated with the production of all other goods in a free market, but so too is the consumption of each good. Insofar as any good is produced by factors of production in limited supply, its price reflects the competitive bidding of the consumers of all the products of those factors. For example, the price of bread in a free market reflects the competitive bidding of the consumers of all wheat products for the use of wheat. The price of gasoline in a free market reflects the competitive bidding of the consumers of all oil products for the use of crude oil, and so on. Now, these facts about the harmonious integration of the production and consumption of each good into the rest of the economic system also have application to how a free market would have responded to the Arab oil embargo. If we had had a free market, the response to the reduction in the supply of oil would have been based on the exercise of the intelligence and judgment of each individual businessman and consumer in the entire economic system. As the price of oil and oil products rose, each individual businessman and consumer would have decided where and to what extent to cut back on the use of oil by consulting his own individual circumstances. Those businessmen would have cut back who had lower cost alternatives available. For example, businessmen with the alternative of switching to coal or shipping by rail or barge instead of truck would have done so. And more would have done so, more and more rapidly, as the price of oil rose higher, because the comparative savings in doing so would have become greater. In the same way, some firms might have concentrated their production in fewer days to conserve fuel. Some might have concentrated production more heavily in plants in warmer parts of the country. Some might have reduced or stopped production entirely because of an inability to sell as many goods at the higher prices necessitated by higher costs of fuel and transportation. The point is that there would have been as many individual responses as there are separate business firms and even subunits within business firms. The responses in each case would have been based on a consideration of the cost of oil and of its alternatives in the individual case. Similarly, each individual consumer would have decided where and to what extent to cut back on the basis of the individual circumstances confronting him. What would have decided in each case was the importance of the particular oil product as determined by the individual consumer's personal needs and desires, dependent on the product, and the extent of his wealth. For example, no one to whom time was essential would have been forced to reduce his driving speed. Nor would a wealthy person have been forced to give up driving his Cadillac. By the same token, no one whose only means of getting to work was an automobile would have gone without gasoline. He would have chosen to go without other things first and to spend the money he saved from somewhere else to buy the necessary gasoline. Anyone in such a position would have been assured of all the gasoline he required because he would certainly have been willing and able to pay more for gasoline for the purpose of getting to work than most other people would have been willing to pay for it for any lesser purpose. To obtain gasoline for getting to work, one would merely have had to outbid other people seeking gasoline for pleasure trips, marginal shopping trips, and so on. More broadly, since more gasoline can always be produced from crude oil, released by producing less of other oil products, an individual needing gasoline to get to work would merely have had to outbid other people seeking crude oil for any lesser purpose than one comparable to that of getting to work. For example, he would have been able to obtain it by outbidding even people far richer than himself who previously used crude oil in the form of heating oil to heat their swimming pools, or perhaps who previously consumed vegetables or flowers grown in hothouses with the aid of large quantities of oil. The specific ways in which oil would have been economized are too numerous to name. It is probably impossible even to learn them all, because they would have depended on an enormous number of individual circumstances, in many cases known only to the individuals directly involved, whoever and wherever they might have been. The essential fact is that oil would have been economized in ways that affected each individual as little as possible. Each individual, consumer and businessman, would have dealt with the problem in the way best suited to his own personal or business context. And at the same time, his efforts would have been harmoniously integrated through the price of oil and oil products with the like efforts of everyone else. Each would have acted on the basis of the price of oil and oil products, and the value judgments of each would have determined just how high those prices would have had to go before the quantity of oil and oil products demanded was leveled down to equality with the reduced supply of crude oil available. In other words, in a free market, the oil crisis would have been met by the conscious planning of each individual harmoniously integrated with that of every other individual. Of course, this is not what occurred because of price controls. All considerations of individual context were dropped. The intelligence and planning of the individuals were paralyzed, as we have already seen. But more of this in later lectures. At this point, we must bring the discussion of the free market to a close. We have seen that the free market constitutes a rational, ordered system of social cooperation. It is governed by the operation of natural laws as comprehensible as those which apply to the physical universe. In essence, in studying the free market, economics merely traces out the inexorable logical consequences implied in man dealing with the physical universe and his fellow men, with reason as his means of survival and his own material self-interest as his motive. We have seen, I believe, a truly awe-inspiring complex of relationships in which individual self-interest unites all industries, all markets, all occupations, all production and all consumption into a harmonious, progressing system serving the well-being of all who participate in it. This is the free market. This is what made possible the economic success of our country. Next week, we will turn our main focus to price controls. We will begin to see more and more fully how they are capable of destroying this country. What we have already learned of price controls is merely an introduction. Thank you. I have a question. What implications are contained in the principle that prices of factors in limited supply are determined with respect to their marginal employments? In other words, if one ignored this principle, what ideological error might result? Well, I thought I explained some of the important implications, namely that if there is any reduction in supply, such as in the oil embargo, the consequences would be minimized. Any increase in the supply of a factor of production gives us the maximum benefit. Now, not to understand this principle is to be unable to realize such things as that under price controls, the controls enable the most marginal uses, like extra shopping trips, to outbid the most vital uses. It means not being able to understand some very important consequences of controls. Now, if one asks what ideological error might result, well, not necessarily any ideological error. One would just be ignorant of some important facts. One could ask what ideological error would result if one knew nothing about prices at all. Well, possibly none, although that's not too likely, but one would be very ignorant about the consequences of price controls. Are there any oral questions? Yes, sir?
Is there a way to determine the exact rate of inflation during a period of a year, say?
Is there a way to determine the exact rate of inflation during the period of a year? Well, one thing that you could do is simply look at the official statistics for the money supply as of the current date and a year earlier. Now, the problem with that is that even in a week, you can have significant changes. Like the money supply in a particular week might be expanded as much to equal a 1% change for the year. So what you could do is consult perhaps a moving average of the money supply based, say, a 10-week moving average, and look at it as of a year ago and as of today. And there are such figures published, not necessarily 10 weeks, but maybe 6 months or whatever. Yeah.
Thinking in terms of, for example, adjusting financial statements, there's a among accountants who use a price index figure to adjust financial statements. Now, would the money supply
right, I see what you mean. You're asking about price indexing of income statements of business enterprises. Now, they would want to use in a price index the change in some price level, maybe the consumer price level or the wholesale price index. They would not be looking simply at the change in the money supply. Now, what that means is they would consult some index and observe, perhaps, that prices in the last year had risen 10%. And then you might deflate your income for tax purposes. Or perhaps you might have an index constructed for the replacement costs of plant and equipment. And in computing depreciation, instead of making the depreciation on an original cost basis, you do it on a replacement cost basis. That would have the effect of reducing reported profits and reducing the taxes on profits. And anything further on that point?
Are those indexes quite
accurate? All right, now you ask, are the indexes accurate? I would say it's foolish to expect them to be accurate to percentage points. You can observe, first of all, the fact that no price index can allow for quality changes. Now, if you're talking about a price index, you have a price of an automobile at the beginning of a period, in some base period, and later. And there can be very significant differences in an automobile or a television set or in food or what have you. No price index is able to take those things into account. Or if they did, they would have to obviously allow for a very wide area of discretion. Would you say, for example, that a car of today should be counted as 1.1 or 1.3 times the car of 1960, or 0.9? I don't know. Obviously, you see, as much discretion as there is in that, or the failure to take that into account, shows you the lack of precision of a price index. In addition, there is a problem of weighting changes in prices. A price index is constructed by comparing the prices of a selected group of goods between two periods of time. And in the construction of the index, each good is given a different weight. Obviously, you'd have to count rents much more heavily than the price of newspapers. If your rent goes up 5%, that's much more significant to you than if the price of your newspapers doubled. So you have to allow different weights. Now here you have a problem in that each individual spends his income differently. Some individuals spend heavily for rent, others more heavily for magazines and newspapers, or whichever. So you could have the same changes in prices, but depending on what weights you used, you could come out with a different change in the index. In the actual indexes used, like the consumer price index, the goods that go into that index are goods which, according to the Department of Labor, are bought by lower middle class urban working families. And if you're not in that class, then you're not buying that mix of goods, and the extent of the rise in prices for you may be very different. So you can rely on a price index. If it says last year prices rose 2% and this year they're rising 10%, you can probably assume that that means something. But if they say last year it was 3.7 and this year it's 5.1, that probably does not mean very much. Yes? All right, you ask, what is the law, or the iron law of wages, as it was called? And you say, what was Ricardo's iron law of wages? Well, now, the iron law of wages was not, in fact, propounded by Ricardo, but let me first say what it was. The iron law of wages was the proposition that in the long run, real wages, namely what a worker can buy with the money he earns, tends to sink to the level of minimum physical subsistence, enough to enable the worker and his wife to reproduce themselves with two children surviving to adulthood. So the iron law of wages held the general level of real wages heads toward minimum physical subsistence. Now, the rationale for the iron law of wages was historical experience prior to the Industrial Revolution. Because what happened prior to the Industrial Revolution is that every time living conditions began to get a little bit above subsistence for the masses of people, the extra income would merely enable a larger number of children to survive to adulthood. Now, as the larger number of children were surviving to adulthood and the population was growing, it was necessary to bring more land under cultivation or cultivate already cultivated land more intensively. Now, if you cultivated already cultivated land more intensively and there was no technological progress, you ran into diminishing returns. You got less than proportional output. If you brought additional land under cultivation, it was almost certainly inferior land, because if it had been better land, you'd have already been cultivating it. So what happened was, as population would grow, the additional output of food could not be increased as fast as the extra population. So the standard of living would diminish. It would head towards subsistence. It couldn't get below subsistence for too long, because if it did, then part of the population died off, as occurred before the Industrial Revolution. As the standard of living would fall below subsistence, people would become weaker, more susceptible to disease, famines could occur. Then the poorest land would be thrown out of cultivation. The existing land would have to be cultivated less intensively. So it was considered that subsistence was the natural level of wages. But observe, the early classical economists, who, like Adam Smith, and there are passages in Ricardo which can be cited to conclude that he upheld this law, they based it on historical observation. They were living in the late 18th or early 19th century. But observe, even in arriving at that conclusion, they did not claim that wages were set at the subsistence level arbitrarily. What drove wages to subsistence was the rise in population when wages got above subsistence, and then diminishing returns. Now, Marx came along and perverted this doctrine of the early classical economists and claimed that the capitalists arbitrarily set wages at the minimum subsistence level. And before I leave this point, I should just mention, in fairness to Ricardo, there are many passages in which he is aware that this law need not hold. He says that wages can be higher than this for an indefinite period, that as fast as population increases, capital could increase still faster. Is not an auction quite different from a free market the way we know it, in that in an auction of gasoline, each gallon would be sold at different prices, the highest price paid by the person receiving the first gallon. In a free market economy, the price of gas would be uniform throughout the area. Now, in an auction, you would not have the highest price paid by the first bidder. It depends, first of all, what kind of auction you have. You can have an auction in which the whole supply is sold at one uniform price. Even if that were not the case, it would not be true that the people willing to pay the most would immediately, right away, bid the most. They would be speculating on what others would be bidding. The principle is essentially the same. Why do you refer to goods being in limited supply? Are there any that are not? Now, in one sense, it is true that there are no goods that are not in limited supply, but in the sense in which I use the term, most manufactured and processed goods are not in limited supply in this sense. Namely, in the case of most manufactured and processed goods, the sellers maintain inventories and they have additional plant capacity. If there is a rise in demand for those goods, the additional demand can be met immediately out of existing inventories, and in the meanwhile, production can be stepped up from the existing capacity before the inventories are exhausted. So in this sense, in these cases, a rise in demand is accompanied by an immediate, instantaneous increase in supply. The demand is not pressing on the limits of the supply, as it is in cases, in other cases normally that I've described. Like in the commodity markets, if you want a larger quantity of a good, you will only be able to obtain it by starting to bid up the price. Because there will be a period of time required before production can be stepped up. If we had a free market in labor, similar principles would apply. Labor is not something that is produced. So you could not immediately be expanding the supply of labor as the demand for it rose. So the contrast was, there are some goods whose prices are determined directly by cost of production. Those are the goods of which the sellers maintain inventories and extra plant capacity. They meet additional demand if it isn't too large an increase. They meet the additional demand at the same price based on cost of production. Dr. Binswanger? All right, now, can I answer the argument that when there's idle capacity, inflation brings the idle capacity into use? Well, now, I had a discussion of this, but we'll go over this. The fact that the prices of many manufactured or most manufactured and processed goods are based on cost and additional demand can be met by additional supply is what provides the idea that by stepping up demand, you will automatically step up production, that's what provides it with its plausibility. The problem is that if you have any widespread increase in demand throughout the economy, and we have widespread labor unions, the unions immediately begin to take advantage of the rise in demand to begin raising wages. So what happens is the rise in demand cannot bring about additional supply, because the rise in wages in response to it starts raising costs of production, and that raises prices. So prices go up before supply can be increased very substantially. Oh, I see. Are there cases in which idle capacity is a good thing? Within certain limits, absolutely. In the same way, ask yourself, think of all of the idle capacity you have around your home or apartment. Different things that you use on different occasions. Like you have, hopefully, idle capacity of your medicine chest all the time. Now, what we want normally is for each industry to have some margin of extra capacity so that if there is additional demand for the products of that industry, the industry supply can be stepped up right away. It can have the people work some overtime or an extra shift or what have you, and it doesn't lack for the material means. If we did not have additional plant capacity, then every time there was an additional demand for something, you'd run up against the fixed limit of the lack of capacity and the price would skyrocket. This is a point I make, incidentally, in the article I had in the Objectivist, Platonic Competition. There are many economists who denounce the fact that we have unused capacity most of the time in most industries, and they believe that the price of every product should sell on the basis of the supply of that product. They believe that every price should be determined on the basis of the independent supply and demand of that particular product. Now, in fact, it isn't, and when they see it isn't, then they attack capitalism for having what they call monopoly prices, oligopoly prices. In fact, it's the perfectly natural circumstance of prices being determined by cost. Yes, I could have used the expression utility. You see, what utility actually means, suppose we use the expression marginal utility. what is the marginal utility of something? It is the utility, really, of the least important among the most important employments of a factor of production. The marginal utility of a factor of production is the utility of that product, which is the least important among the most important. Now, this concept of least important among the most important, I know, is a little tricky. What you have to do, let me give you an example from Bombavik himself. And this is in his book, Capital and Interest, in the section Value and Price. He imagines a hypothetical, isolated settler somewhere off on a desert island. And this settler is fortunate enough to have with him 5 sacks of wheat. Now let's assume that he needs 1 sack in order to barely stay alive, in order to have enough bread to get through the next months. A second sack will enable him to have enough bread to be more comfortable. With a third sack, he might still have some more bread. With a fourth, he makes whiskey. With a fifth, he feeds a parrot. Now, you might imagine that each sack has a little tag attached to it denoting its specific use. But now ask yourself, suppose by some accident one of these sacks were destroyed, any one of the sacks. What want satisfactions would be lost as a result? Suppose the sack labeled sack for survival is destroyed. Now, where would the actual loss be taken out? He would stop feeding the parrot. All right, so now, what is the importance of any one sack when you've got 5? The importance of any one is equal to the importance of the least important among those 5. Now, suppose he had only 4 sacks. Now, if he loses 1 out of the 4, the importance of the least important among the 4 is the making of whiskey. If he had only 1 sack, the least important is that 1 sack itself, that's his very life. Dr. Binswanger? All right, suppose he has 4 sacks. Now, just on the basis of this example, these 4 sacks have 5 potential employments. Now, if he has 4 sacks, does he value a sack at the importance of feeding a parrot? No, that's a submarginal employment. He values it at the least important among the most important. Yeah, the most important, you see, you can think of, as a supply grows, each successive unit is devoted to its most important employment in descending order. So the last unit is devoted to its most important employment, but that's less important than any of the previous units, and more important than any of the next units for which you don't yet have a supply. Yes? Right. And then if he loses still a third one, he begins to feel hungry himself. And that same principle applies in our economy. Suppose we have a bad harvest. Now what goes? Do people stop eating bread? No, what happens is there's a rise in the price of grain. This represents a rise in the costs of feeding meat animals. They go. If we had, it would take in this country disastrously bad harvests, beyond imagination, before we would start eating less bread. The marginal employments are in the feeding of meat animals, the making of whiskey, and so on. But in India, India is a 1 sack country. And so if they have a shortage, then people are dying literally in the streets. Young lady, yes?
Thank you.
All right. You're saying, suppose you've got 5 sacks. Yeah. Right. Right. Okay, now, not only could you have a sixth use, but you could have a sixth through 60th use. Now observe, the least important use among all of the different potential uses would be the lowest possible employment you could imagine. Yeah, you can say it's still an important use, but it is the least important among the most important. Now observe, the least important among the most important is more important than the most important. Okay. You want to repeat it? Now the way to name it is, the marginal employment is more important than the most important submarginal employment. Yes, any use that requires more of the factor than you've got would be less important than the uses that you devote it to. It would be submarginal. Dr. Gotthelf? Oh, you're asking about how narrowly would we classify the goods? All right, now you're asking, would we make a distinction, say, between white bread and rye bread, or whichever? Well, I think that would depend on the context. For many purposes, we can talk just about bread. In other contexts, it might be necessary to make a distinction between different types. I don't think you could make any hard and fast rule about it. The same principles would apply, yes. See, suppose we're looking at automobiles. We could apply the concept submarginal in this way. If you are making, let's say, $10,000 a year, and you want an automobile, you might end up having to buy a Pinto or a Volkswagen or something. In your context, the quality advantages that a Cadillac would give you are submarginal. If you are making $30,000 a year, the superiority of a Cadillac over a Pinto would be supramarginal. See, the wealthier you are, the further out you can carry the satisfaction of your wants. You can satisfy your wants to degrees that are progressively less important that you would, if you had to choose, you'd give up first. You give them up before giving up certain other things. Yes? Well, the Russian grain deals make the price of grain and all grain products in the United States higher. And the added irony of it is that the Russians, for the most part certainly, are not in fact buying this grain. They're getting it on credit, which means they're getting it for nothing because they don't pay their loans, which means that American taxpayers are turning over money with one fist that the Russians are then able to use to bid up the prices of the things that we have to buy, or many of the things that we have to buy. Yes? Who is it that lends them the money? The United States government. Either the United States government gives them direct loans, or it guarantees the loans extended by private firms. Yes, sir? All right, now, if they paid in gold for the wheat, they would still be driving up the price, but at least we'd have the gold. But they wouldn't be able to do that very much because they don't mine as much gold as is required to meet to begin to meet all of the imports that they need. So they get most of their imports through credit. Now, would you briefly outline, this is a question from an earlier lecture, would you briefly outline how inflation causes unemployment? Well, there are a variety of ways. One way is simply that workers begin to discount the inflation. They start asking for wage increases in anticipation of price increases to come. This means that wages begin to go up even before the demand for labor rises. This itself creates a tendency toward unemployment. If they over-discount the rise in prices, if they start asking wage increases that exceed the inflation that would otherwise occur, and then that inflation doesn't materialize, like imagine they expect prices to rise 25 or 30%, and the government only increases the quantity of money 10 or 15%, well then you have a tremendous rise in wages, a relatively lesser rise in the demand for goods and for labor. If you look back at the price level formula in lecture one, if you raise demand 15%, but you raise wages and prices 30%, the quantity of goods that you could sell, the quantity of labor that you could employ would be radically reduced. Mr. Markowitz? Would the immediate direct effect of inflation be to reduce unemployment by reducing real wages, you say?
Yes, before the wage increase
is drastic, in the very early stages of an inflation, if people are not expecting further inflation and they're unused to it, for a time, increasing the quantity of money might cause some expansion in employment. But very quickly, if you have widespread unionization in the economy, profit margins begin to rise in response to the additional demand. Many prices begin to go up, the prices of goods in limited supply, so wage increases quickly begin to follow. And then they do start discounting the effects. And then the very fact that real wages do tend to fall in an inflation itself becomes the cause of unemployment, because the unions try to raise wages fast enough to prevent any decline in real wages. And that's an additional cause of trying to raise money wages. That causes more unemployment. Could you please explain again how prices of factors in limited supply are determined with respect to their marginal employments? Well, simply in this sense, the price of a factor of production must be low enough to make its use profitable to all of the industries that use it. So the price of wheat has to be low enough to make its use profitable to every industry that uses wheat, including the raising of cattle. But all industries buy wheat at the same price. Well, that means the price of wheat is set at a point low enough to enable its marginal use to be profitable, and all other industries pay the same price. So that's how the price of a factor is determined with respect to its marginal employments. Yes, sir? Yes, you.
Where
In what sense is it to one's self-interest? Well, simply in the sense that if you value something above the price and you are willing and able to pay it, it is to your self-interest to pay a price that is high enough to get you the good you want. It's exactly the same case as it is to the self-interest of the bidder at the art auction to bid above $1,000 if he values the painting above $1,000 in order to eliminate the other bidder. Well, if what I in fact want is a fourth room, it is against my interest to have a price that is so low that it permits someone else to get that room who is not willing to pay as much for it as I am. So simply in that sense. So if you really want something and you value it above the market price has the function of preventing someone else who values the thing less from getting it at your expense. So therefore, it's to your interest. Yes? All right, how is it to the interest of the person who has less ability? All right, I gave one example of that, of how it is to my interest that the price of Rembrandt paintings excludes me. If I could bid on the same terms as industrial tycoons for the greatest luxuries, and that would mean that they could not live at a standard of living better than I could. Well, then why should they do more than I do? If they didn't do more than I do, where would I be? That's one line of explanation. Another factor is, look at the case of the competition for crude oil between the owners of oil wells needing lubricants and the owners of garages wanting to heat their garages. Now, in the long run, if you are a garage owner, is it to your interest that you get crude oil to heat your garage at the expense of an oil derrick not being able to function? That's against your interest. Is it to your interest, if you're a housewife, that crude oil is devoted to producing gasoline for you to go shopping with to take an extra trip that you could really avoid at the expense of fuel being lacking to deliver supplies to the supermarket? See, these things actually start reducing production. They cause chaos. And what's happening, think also of the fact that the same individuals are buying various products of the same good. What you can have with price controls, take the example of oil again. If the price of crude oil is set too low, and the prices of all of the different oil products are too low, that means you as an individual may find the price of buying hothouse vegetables or hothouse flowers, let's say, you might find that their price is within your reach. So you buy those goods, and now you've used the crude oil that would have been used to heat your home. So your own individual purchases are disrupted because you are led to buy submarginal uses, and you deprive yourself of the supply for more important uses. But I don't want to get any further into this because this is anticipating later lectures. Yes? All right, you'd have to wait until lectures 6 and 7. I have a lot to say about that. Mr. Kirkpatrick? All right, what is the rationale behind government programs like the soil bank or any kind of farm subsidy? Now, that is a minimum price, the opposite of the kind we're focusing on. That's a measure designed to artificially raise the price of wheat. The rationale actually is that the farmers have a lot of votes in Congress, and they're voting themselves a subsidy at the expense of the rest of the population. Now, there are also some very half-baked arguments which are thrown up as a rationalization, such as, if we tax ourselves to buy the farmer's wheat, which we store in caves or give away to the Russians, if we do that, then the farmers have money to buy our goods in the city. This is a line you get in the New York City school system. Now, if that were true, then it would be to the interest of restaurants to have their doormen out front giving people money if they would agree to buy their dinner in the restaurants. I mean, that's the best rationale that there is. There is no semi-legitimate argument in favor of it. Yes? Yeah, very often when the government, as Mr. Markowitz is pointing out, when the government does buy up surpluses of crops, unless it physically destroys them or allows them to rot, if the time comes when they have to be unloaded, then the situation is much worse than it would have been for the farmers if the government had never gotten involved. But in the case of the American farm subsidies, the crops are allowed to rot or they're given away. They have not been a problem on the market. Just let me try to read one or two of these other questions. In the example of the art dealer, what would prevent the dealer from simply setting the price at $2,000, since there was at best one person willing to pay $2,000? All right, now the answer to that is the dealer does not necessarily know the maximum of the seller. And you could reverse the question. What is a dealer usually willing to sell something for if he had no other alternative? In the long run, if there were no market for it, it's just occupying space in his shop, he'd be willing to give it away. Well, one could ask, if you had one buyer and one seller, why doesn't the buyer make the dealer give the thing away for practically nothing? Or if we have two buyers, why can't the stronger buyer force the seller to sell to him at $1,001? Here it's an issue simply of patience, bargaining power, and things of that type. Now you ask, in fact, what would prevent all sellers from setting arbitrarily high prices and lowering them gradually until all the supply was sold? Well, one thing is the buyers speculate on the price. The fact that you are willing to pay $2,000 for something, but there are others who will only pay $200, and you know or you believe that fairly soon they will be sold to at $200, means that you're not going to be willing to buy above $200 either. You'll speculate on it. So even people willing to pay a high price do not have to if other people will buy at a low price. They hold out. So we can conclude at this point. Thank you very much.